I've been throwing horseshoes over my left shoulder. I've spent most all my life searching for that four-leaf clover. Yet you run with me, chasing my rainbow. Honey, I love you too. That's the way love goes. Gets old, it only grows. Losing makes me sorry. You say, honey, don't worry. Honey, I love you too. That's the way love goes. Honey, I love you too. That's the way love goes.
Hey, pretty baby, are you ready for me? Get your good rockin' daddy down from Tennessee. I'm just out off about San Antonio with a radio blasting in the bird dog.
If you're a country music fan, particularly classic country, join me, Cope Reynolds, every Friday night for Liberty Lounge right here on the Survival Circle Network. Absolutely the fastest 2 hours on internet radio. Liberty Lounge. Every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, 10 to midnight Eastern. Right here on Survival Circle.
You have a weapon?
Yeah, a big one. How about you?
You sure you want to get cute with me? You have a backup weapon?
Never had the need.
Get one. Keep that in your suit unless I tell you to take it out. Get yourself a Glock. Lose that nickel-plated sissy pistol.
And it's time for the shooting bench. If political incorrectness offends you, or if you don't like guns, or if you don't believe our government is corrupt enough to compare to 1938 Nazi Germany, this may not be the show for you, because for the next 2 hours, that's all we're going to talk about. You need to understand that there's a storm coming. You need to understand that the storm is building strength. And most of all, you need to understand that
we are the storm.
All right, and welcome to the shooting bench. It's the 16th of November, getting pretty close to Thanksgiving. It's a Wednesday, and hope you guys had a good day off there. We're gonna kind of hard for me to get used to this new schedule yet, trying to have a day off in between broadcasting days there, but I'm trying to get used to it. We may go back to 5 days a week, but not anytime real soon. We're gonna try to take a break here for a little while. As usual, heck of a lot of stuff going on right now. One thing that's coming up here this coming weekend, Saturday on the 19th, we'll have another community emergency response preparedness training class over in Snowflake. And it'll be at the... I knew somebody was going to ask me that, and I forgot to have it ready here. Let me see, for those of you that are local, I'll get you the venue, get you the address up here in just a second, or 2 seconds or something like that. No, that's not right. I promise I will. There we go. There, it's under preparedness seminars. All right, this one is coming up in the White Mountain Physical Training Building at 121 North Main Street in Taylor. Taylor and Snowflake's about growed together there, so I keep saying Snowflake, but it's actually going to be in Taylor. So, starts at 8 o'clock in the morning, goes till around 5. Doors will open about 7:30. And if you want to bring your lunch, you're welcome to. I'm going to stay there through lunch and have a Q&A type thing while we're eating lunch. If you want to go out to one of the local restaurants, that's fine too. We'll take an hour for lunch, and then we'll get back and hit it pretty hard and get into our second half of that. So, let's see, and we're putting together the same class coming up in Mesa, or Phoenix, and I've got a guy, as we sprecken right now, looking into a place to have this, and it's going to be a pretty good size place. I think it's going to be the same place that Chris Ann Hall used here, four or five months ago. We went down there and pulled security for her, and nice place. If we get it, then we'll announce a date. But right now, it will probably be looking at end of December, maybe sometime between Christmas and New Year's, or somewhere in that area. Not sure yet. We'll find out where it's going to be, and then we'll set a date for it. One of the... You know, I got to touch on this. And let me go back to the chat room here. Doc, you had mentioned something here a couple of days ago about something for us to talk about. And, of course, I didn't write it down. So I guess you'll have to remember me what it was. And then overall, that's a good topic for reloading. We might do that second half of the show. If you're up for it, I'll just be kind of pulling it off the cuff, but I know that you're prepared and ready. So if you want to, we can do it the second half of the show today. If not, we can do it next week, next Wednesday. Totally up to you. So I've got to throw in a little deal. Hey, don't worry about it, brother. If you're tired and want to go to sleep, well, knock yourself out. Or to have somebody else knock you out, or whatever it takes. And we'll do it next Wednesday if you want. So, okay. We got to hit a little safety deal here again. It's a shame that so many of these things are so tragic. But, you know, it's not just a matter. It's almost never a matter of, well, the guy accidentally pulled the trigger and the gun hit the pavement and ricocheted harmlessly off into the woods. It's always... You know, the guy accidentally pulled the trigger and killed his wife, or shot himself and had to have his leg amputated, or killed his son, or something like that. And this one it's not quite as bad as some of them, but it's pretty bad. And it's, again, a four-year-old. Remember, it was a four-year-old. It seems like four-year-olds are, I don't know if it's the terrible threes, but it's the... Four-year-olds seem to be the ones that pull the trigger the most. Remember here some time ago, there was a grandma shopping, I believe it was in North Carolina. Four-year-old in the cart. Grandma turned around to get a can of green beans off the shelf or something there, and was about to turn back around, and the little girl had pulled her handgun out of grandma's purse, shot herself in the head, and killed herself. Well, this one is almost like that, but not quite as bad. This was in Indianapolis. Girl grabbed the gun from the parents' nightstand and pulled the trigger. She shot herself in the cheek, and then the bullet hit her mom in the head. But both of them were taken to the hospital in stable condition. The mother's conscious and alert, but in pretty serious condition, but it doesn't appear to be life-threatening at this time. But the problem here is that she had, it said from the nightstand. I don't know if it was laying on the nightstand or if it was in a drawer in the nightstand. Either way, it was unsecured while the four-year-old came in and got a hold of it. And that is absolutely unacceptable. If you have little kids, you've got to be, I don't know how many thousand times I've said this over the years, but you have got to be more responsible with your firearms when it comes to little kids. You know, for the most part, of course, they get to a certain age. When my kids were 4 and 5 years old, they already knew better. They were already shooting. When the time they were 4, they'd already been shooting for a year. And they had a pretty good idea what was going on, even at that young and tender age. But even that, we didn't leave guns laying around loaded. I don't know what the parents were doing or where they were at. The mom obviously was sitting on the bed or laying there close to it, since she shot her too. And that's good, Doc. That's a good way to do it. And for those of you not on the chat room, Doc says, and this is good advice, when the granddaughter comes to visit, secure all firearms except for the one next to the bed, and that one is not chambered. 3 and 4 or 5 year old kids cannot chamber a semi-automatic. They cannot chamber around in there. It might as well be a lead weight. Once they get up about 6 or so, then some of the smaller caliber guns they probably can, especially if they've ever been taught to. But if they've been taught to, then we would hope that some of that teaching will also had to do with included safety and handling and whatnot. So, but at any rate, you know, 4 or 5 years old, they're not really responsible for what they do. So it's up to mom and dad, up to the adult, whoever it may be, uncle, grandpa, whatever, to keep this away from the, keep it away from the kids. Other kids in the house, none of them were hurt. Right now they don't know if the parents are going to face any charges or not, but I would say right now probably not, just guessing. Let me get rid of that. You know, we don't hear this too often, but this one is an exception. We had talked some time ago about the cop that shot Philando Castile in Minnesota, and he was a black guy, and that's why it caused quite a stir there. And the thing about this one, though, is it was caught live on Facebook. It wasn't an altered video or whatever. It was caught live, and he was just not able to use that same excuse. You know, he feared for his life. So he will be charged with second-degree manslaughter and dangerous discharge of a firearm. So it's not any consolation to the victim's family, I'm sure, but at least it appears to be, you know, justice served here. So that's good. It's you know, cops are stuck with a terrible decisions. It's hard to make these decisions sometimes, and sometimes we look at it and we feel that it's wrong, and it and you can look at a video and watch it over and over and still swear that it's wrong. And sometimes it is. Sometimes they are absolutely at fault, like this one. But a lot of times there's things that just the video just can't catch, that the cop will sense or see that the angle of the video didn't catch. And oftentimes it was exactly as they say, that they feared for their life. But there's also the times when they've made a mistake and They claim that to try to stay out of trouble. Well, it didn't work on this one. You remember the guy that in the subway here has been several years ago now where the cop was, they already had the guy down on the ground, two guys holding him down, had cuffs on, laying on his stomach on concrete, and the guy panicked, with had his handgun out, shot him in the back, killed him. Not much way out of that one. There was the female officer in Las Vegas quite a few years ago. They had another guy down on the ground, stomach or face down, handcuffed, and the woman is still with the female officer standing there, all excited, and pulled the trigger, hit the concrete about 6 or 8 inches from the guy's head, the guy that was cuffed and laying down on the ground. Hit the sidewalk about 6 inches from his head, scared him to death. You could tell by the way he flinched that concrete, splinters and shrapnel and gravel and whatever hit him in the side of the face. But anyway, she right away put her gun up and act like nothing happened there. So, I understand that sometimes accidents happen, but we can certainly reduce that dramatically by proper firearm handling. And if you haven't noticed, the ATF, if you haven't heard already, the ATF is coming out with a new background check form, a new 4473. The last one was updated in April of 2012. That when we were still going strong there in Pine Top. This new one contains more than 50 changes. Now, how can you change that little form 50 times? It includes an addition of the definition for fugitive from justice. This is a term that has been a dispute for a long time between the ATF and the FBI, and allowed the transfer of more than 2,000 guns to accused criminals. The FBI denied 49,448 gun sales between 1999 and 2015 because of background checks revealed active warrants for the buyers. So, I don't know what all the 50 changes are, but apparently that's one of the bigger ones. That's what this whole story is about here. But we'll see. As soon as they come out, I'll get a hold of one and we'll talk about it. Like I said, I am seriously looking at getting my FFL back. I really want to try to do it, to have it, right after the first of the year. So I'm hoping if all goes well that we'll be able to do that here before the end of this month. So there you have it. speaking of safety, sometimes I probably shouldn't laugh at this, but sometimes it just irony or poetic justice. Stand by a minute. Poetic justice is maybe what this is. There's a guy here that protesting Trump. I still haven't figured out what everybody's protesting Trump about. I guess because they're going to take away all their, take away their entitlements and make them work for a living and whatnot. And maybe that's why they're all mad. I don't know. But this Black Lives Matter guy protesting Trump with a selfie. And I'm not sure exactly what the purpose of this was. What it was supposed to accomplish. But this is the second one, because of Trump, that has shot himself in the head. This guy is taking a selfie. He's got the gun pointed at his face. And somehow or another, pulled the trigger and blew his face off. Gun went off, shot him in the head, died instantly. They say that the man had apparently been greatly against Donald Trump, and many of his selfies included violence and profanities directed toward the presidential candidate. According to his girlfriend, the photo was supposed to be a joke,
about killing himself if Donald Trump were elected president. Well, there you go. Be careful what you wish for. She told the police this was not his first selfie with the weapon. The fatal accident took place over the weekend. Said he thought the gun was unloaded. Attempted to take a selfie while pointing the weapon at himself. Alrighty then. Well, however, this was not the case. The man's last selfie, he apparently left one fatal bullet inside the chamber before the final photograph. Oh, well. It's one of those things. There's, Well, I can't read that one to you. That's a whole another deal there. In Reno, and by the way, let me go back. Let me cruise up the chat room here just a little bit and see what, see who all we got in here. I'm going to check and see here. I would if my thing was working. There it goes. Got Charlie Bound, Concretin. Concretin, you're up a little late if you're still on there with us. The Tinker and Doc, Matty Buck, good to see you guys. Where is Lima 20 Alpha? Maybe he's listening to Matty Buck there. Mother Earth, Peanut Rider, Radio Doc, Rolex, Snowman. Yeah, come on, it looks like you're the only one, excuse me. Looks like you're the only one from Washington again. We got to get on those Washington folks. I know usually we got a 10 of them in here. No, let's see. Yeah, I don't see Susie B or any of them in there. All right. Well, I'm glad y'all made it anyhow. So, I need to go up here and check and see if Doc is going to be prepared to talk about overall length tonight. We had talked about this here a few days ago. Thought it would be a good topic for the show. And if we're going to do that, we'll do it here in about 7 or 8 minutes. So let me know, Doc, if you want to do it, we'll do it. Rolex says the new 4473 accounts for the current legal interpretation of firearms disabilities, meaning a person cannot purchase a firearm for certain non-immigrant aliens. I'm glad they cleared that up. The definition and application period are relatively technical. However, use of the April 2012 4473 form ensures proper FFL operations. This is what is new content on these variants. All right, I'll have to get one of them and check and see. They'll be available in a PDF form online here as soon as they become available. So I'll get one and we'll check it out together. So I think while we're waiting to see what Doc's going to do, I'm going to play the I Love This Song by the Statler Brothers. So we're going to play this and I'll be back in a minute. Stand by.
God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy power throughout the display. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How thou art, how great thou art. station and take me home. What joy shall fill my heart? Then I shall bow in humble adoration and there proclaim, my God, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God to thee, how great thou art, how great thou art.
Welcome back to another segment of the Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Kiss Radio me. Network. All right, we're back. So another thing I wanted to share with you here real quick. It's not a big deal, but those of you that were in the military back in 02, oh, too long ago, not 02, 2002. But you'll remember the, what was it, the 151s? 151, 152, the little Jeeps? Well, they're talking about bringing that back. They're looking at bringing the Jeep back into the... So I think it's a great idea. I was never a big fan of the Humvees. They work all right in the desert, but in woods and the rocks and stuff, they're wide. And I don't think they were as, now the upside is they can carry a lot more equipment and personnel and medical supplies and all that. And the little Jeeps were, not so much, but, they were sure mobile. You could take those little things anywhere and you could get, six GIs on there or four good healthy ones and pick that thing up and set it up on the sidewalk you could just do anything with those little Jeeps. They were a lot of fun. The other side, the other downside of those is they turned over real easy. If you get in a little bit of a hurry, especially on unlevel ground, they were not hard to turn over at all. As a matter of fact, one of my jobs when I was in Fort Irwin was to, they were building a roll cage for the current Jeeps that we had then. This was just before the Humvees. And my job was to take one of my trucks out of my motor pool. I had the, for those of you that are familiar, I had the heavy equipment transports, big trucks. Not big trucks like you see on the highway, but big trucks. And I've got pictures of it. We tied one of those on the back, and my job was to scoot across the desert and turn that thing sharp enough to roll that Jeep. And they wanted to get at least two rolls out of it, two complete revolutions. So, and we finally did accomplish it and rolled it down a hill. And they had some mannequins buckled up in the front seats, and they, they were trying to see if there's what, if any, damage there would be, or injuries there would be to these guys. So that was kind of fun. I wish we'd have had the, videos and cell phones available back in those days that we've got now. Would have been a lot more, been able to document that a lot better. It was documented. The Army filmed it, but I never got a copy of it.
Got some still pictures. That was fun. Okay. Doc says he's ready. We'll call him. So let's give him a holler here. And we're going to talk about overall length and reloading just a little bit. It is much more important than some people give it credit for. So let's see if this is going to work here. All right. Coming up, Doc, if you're ready, it's going to be ringing here momentarily. I guess. If it's where I actually had some trouble with Skype today, and I'm trying to work it out, and apparently, well, maybe it's working. Well, I don't hear it ringing, and I don't hear him talking. Says call failed. All right, let's try that one more time. See what happens. All right, Doc, here it comes again. Now, I did. Kind of planning on down on the.
Good evening, Cope.
There it is. Now it's working. How you doing tonight, Doc?
I am well. How are you?
Oh, man. I am great and just happy to be here.
And just for your edification, that was my fault, not yours, that the call didn't go in.
Oh, okay.
I realized that turning on Skype might help.
Yes. They say it does. So, all right. Well, you had a good idea about talking about overall length. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, your brass, you have an overall length, which is your bullet, the length of the case and the bullet seated in it. And then you have your trim length, or case length, which is the length of the case without the bullet in it, both very important for different reasons. So, Doc, let's talk about overall length to start with, and then we'll go into case length.
Well, a couple of things. As I'm sure you would agree, the vast majority of problems with semi-automatic pistols can be traced to magazines, mm-hmm. usually not the firearm itself. But in addition to magazine problems, case overall length is critical to the proper functioning of virtually all semi-automatic weapons, whether they're handguns, long guns, shotguns, anything of that sort. And the specs are often not closely followed even by manufacturers. For instance, the case overall length, and that's the brass case and bullet combined, is 1.275 inches for the .45 ACP. That's the official specification and dimensions that goes back well over 100 years. But I have measured any number of factory-produced 45 hardball rounds, and very few are loaded to that specification. I find results all over the board, and this comes from, well-known factory new ammunition and a host of, more localized reloaders, commercial reloaders who sell their wares at, gun shops and gun shows. So before you categorically dismiss a given pistol, and this is especially true for pistols, as being junk or being problematic, I would try several different types of ammunition in it, and if you reload, try, for instance, to adjust the bullet seating depth, which affects the case overall length.
Mm-hmm.
If you check on reloading boards, and I haven't made a comprehensive study of this, I'm just talking about casually cruising different sites, you'll see a ton of guys say to reload hardball, 45 hardball, at 1.25. I've tried that at times in the past. It seems to work fine in my pistols, but the official factory spec of 1.275 works equally well. Another thing that a lot of people aren't aware of is that different bullets require different overall lengths. So, using that 45 example, if The case overall length for hardball is 1.275 inches. Don't then assume that you could take, say, a 200-grain semi-wad cutter and expect that to be the appropriate length, because it won't be. It's going to be way too long for a semi-wad cutter. Now, that is more or less things that will cause you some grief at the range. You know, there could be self-defense situations where a misfunction is deadly, but for 99.999% of the time, when people are having malfunctions, it's something they notice when they're, you know, shooting casually or shooting at the range or at a match. It's not likely to be a life-threatening situation. However, there is a life-threatening situation related to case overall length, which very few people seem to be aware of. And that's if a bullet is seated too deeply in a case, and mm-hmm. this applies to rifles as well as pistols, it can dramatically increase the chamber pressure. For instance, and I don't have a piezoelectric transducer or any way to directly measure pressure, but this is just according to my reading. A 45 ACP case had the bullet intentionally compressed into the case, so the case overall length was very short, and they measured it, and the fact that the bullet was seated so deeply gave them a chamber pressure of about 35,000 psi.
And it's normally, and what, about 22,000 or something like that?
On the high end, yeah. The low end is 19,000. So, you know,
jump.
You're getting right up there to 357 and 9mm pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if you had a bullet seated too deeply in 9mm or 357 or any other cartridge, the pressures could spike dramatically. Now, you know, if you're not intending to seat a bullet too deeply, there's a real common way that it can happen, and it actually happens frequently, and I'm not even going to throw you a hint, Cope. Tell me what it is. What causes a bullet to seat too deeply?
Well, a buildup of wax and stuff up in the seating die can do it.
Well, I'm thinking something a little more immediate, and that's when you go to chamber a round in a pistol.
Oh, I thought you were talking about during the reloading process itself.
Well, I'm sorry if I was confusing there, but I'm sure you've seen this 100 times, Cope. If the bullet hangs up on the ramp or the chamber lip,
yep,
it can force that bullet deeper into the case.
And for those that unload every night or frequently for whatever reason and keep chambering the same round over and over, you better watch that one real close, because it could be... you'd be hammering that bullet back in the case on some types of guns more than others. And on the 40 Smith & Wesson, it's particularly dangerous. It only takes just a few thousandths of an inch to boost those pressures way up there.
Yeah, the 40 S&W is notorious for that. It's a very case overall length sensitive round.
Yep.
So if you do reload, I mean, here's my rule of thumb. Before you seat the bullet, you should bell the case mouth. All your die sets should have a little ball or a ovoid-shaped protrusion in the die. And bell the case mouth so it can then accept the bullet. And, you know, casually with a couple of friends and internet lore, I've seen people tend to make that bell too big.
Yeah.
All you need to do after you've resized the case is barely flare it so it will just accept the bullet. And then when you seat the bullet to whatever depth you decide, along the wall of the case, you should see the slightest little bulge. You might not even be able to feel it, but if you look at it in the light correctly, you'll see where the seated bullet has re-expanded that brass ever so slightly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what that will do, you basically sort of, this probably isn't the right term, but you've kind of put a reverse cannelure in the case. You've actually given that bullet a little rim to sit on, or a little shelf to sit on in the case. And that will help it from going deeper into the case when you cycle a weapon.
Yeah, and that's when he says accept the bullet, that doesn't mean that the bullet sits halfway down in the case. It means that just the first probably less than a 16th of an inch, if it sits in there at all, this tiniest little bit, that's enough. It doesn't take a whole lot. You don't need to flare that open where the bullet sits down in there, you know, a quarter of an inch before you ever start to. And it also is a lot of. It also work hardens that brass. You're opening it up too much and crimping it or seating the bullet there, and you do that a few times, and that brass is going to wear out pretty quickly.
Now, in chat, Rolex said, do not crimp a 9mm, and here I think we have to define terms.
Yeah, exactly.
I think what he's referring to is crimping the brass into the bullet. You know, a lot of bullets will typically have a cantilever or a little ridge around them, and with revolvers, you generally slightly crimp the brass into that cantilever.
Right.
On pistols, semi-automatic pistols, you shouldn't do that. Because virtually all of them headspace on the case mouth. But you do effectively crimp the case somewhat when you resize the brass. You shrink it back down to below its original size because the brass does expand when the round is fired.
Mm-hmm.
And some die makers now are producing what they call a taper crimp die. I don't use them. I don't think they're necessary.
I don't either.
But that's not the same thing as, I think, what Rolex was talking about, crimping the case into the bullet.
Yeah.
You don't do that with a semi-automatic.
Taper crimp versus a roll crimp.
Correct, a roll crimp.
Yeah, roll crimps are vital on heavy 357s and 44s and stuff, 41s, whatever, your magnum rounds, so that to keep that bullet in place. The recoil can actually make that bullet jump forward and lock that gun up.
And another interesting thing, you know, I always tell people, observe the manuals religiously. It's not a place to experiment. But, and this has always thrown me for a loop, I'm sure Cope has seen this many times, and Peanut Rider and the experienced reloaders, you can look at different manuals from different companies and see their overall length has different specs for what amounts to identical bullets,
mm-hmm.
which can be kind of confusing.
Yeah, that's why I always tell people get at least two manuals and preferably three or four, especially when you're starting out with a new cartridge or a new bullet in an old cartridge or something, and compare those and generally start at the lowest, you know, just kind of get an average to start at and not just pick one manual, because some of these manuals, one from, which one is it? It's in California. Is it Sierra? I don't remember. But these were formed at different elevations. And some of these max loads that were developed in Lewiston, Idaho were not necessarily the same as the ones that were developed in Nebraska at Hornady's plant.
And here's where you can get in trouble. I recommend that people load somewhere in the middle range of whatever the manual tells them. For one thing, you'll almost never get the best accuracy out of the highest loads in any cartridge. But it's yet another safety consideration, because if you load to the middle ranges, maybe a little on the high side, but still not close to max, that gives you a little more breathing room when it comes to that bullet seating depth.
Right.
So, Cope used the example of the 40S&W, which is well known to be sensitive to bullet depth and pressure. It's already a very high pressure round. And so let's say you pull out your trusty manual and you find the appropriate powder and you load to the very top of the range. And then you happen to seat your bullet too deep. Then, you know, that's kind of an accident waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm. Serious and accident, potentially.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Cope.
I just said potentially a serious accident.
And Rolex made a good point in chat. He said his number 13 spear book is different than his number 14 edition. And I've noticed that, too. Bullet seating depth, powder charges, all of that can display some subtle differences over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
Another thing, Peanut Rider said, he said the Alliant Powder Guide in recent years has deleted most of their pistol data that use shotgun powder such as Red Dot. And I think that's the lawyers talking, because I've been using Red Dot for ages and ages without a problem. I noticed the same thing with Blue Dot. They recently stopped publishing data for it to use in .357.
Blue Dot is still my absolute favorite for 40 Smith & Wesson and 10 millimeter. It's good in all your Magnum shells, but I really, really like it in the 40 calibers.
Yeah, so again, you know, I think that's the lawyers talking. The powders haven't changed. The physics haven't changed. So they probably had one or two episodes, and I would suspect it was somebody not really knowing what they were doing, where there was some kind of an accident and threatened litigation, and so the lawyers came in and said, don't recommend this powder for this application anymore.
I bet that's exactly right. Yeah, but you said...
Exactly. So if any of you guys who reload are having trouble getting a pistol to cycle, you might experiment a little bit with your case overall length. It can turn a pig that, you know, won't cycle and malfunctions every fourth or fifth round. In some cases, it can turn it into a 100% shooter.
Yeah, and sometimes, depending on you know, some magazines, you can get long that they'll slow the rounds down coming up out of the magazine, and you'll have feeding problems because it's the overall length shows problems before it even gets in the chamber. They can drag
Very
on
true.
That magazine a little bit.
So that's really the high points, really all I wanted to discuss, Cope, unless you have something else you want to add before I go.
Well, one more thing, that's overall length. The case length itself, without the bullet, is crucial when it comes to, and we talked about the crimping, and that's one of the reasons we don't give roll crimps on semi-automatic handgun cases, because they... headspace on that rim, we mentioned that briefly, but if you don't trim that brass and keep it within that 5 thousandths, I think, or whatever it is, then you can actually have rounds that were you can trim them too much and get them too short in the firing pin. Sometimes you'll have light firing pin strikes or even misfires completely because the round is too short. Or you can have it stick out too far, and the breech won't close all the way because of the long brass. So it's important. Now, a revolver, you don't see that as much. You can get carried away with it and get way too long, but 20 thousandths one way or the other is not going to make a bit of difference in a revolver. Maybe in accuracy, but not in safety or function. But in the semi-automatic, it certainly will.
Generally speaking, most modern pistols will not allow the firing pin or the hammer to drop if the weapon is not fully in battery.
Hopefully. That's
the key word, hopefully, because there's mechanical tolerances, you know, that might be a little sloppy. So you could, you know, get one of those borderline cases where the breech isn't fully in battery and yet the firing pin does fall. And you know, good way to blow up a gun. If it's a handgun like a 9mm or a 45, you're probably not going to kill yourself, but you could wreck your gun, lose an eye, maybe lose a finger or two.
Yeah, technical term for that is bad.
Or kaboom.
Yeah, not a good thing at all. But one of your bigger, you know, 10 millimeter, 40, something like that, where that were to happen. And another thing, you may have, there's a possibility of having a dirty firing pin chamber in some of these guns where the firing pin is not retracted fully. SKS is famous for that sometimes, and you may wind up with a round that doesn't seat all the way, and if that firing pin does happen to be protruding slightly, especially in the older guns, then that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, the SKS is kind of notorious for that because it's got a floating firing pin and no spring, no retraction spring.
Right. It gets dirty and hot, and that could turn into to a fast shooter pretty quick.
And Rolex brought up another good point. He mentioned pressure spike being shorter than recommended. And this gets a little bit esoteric, but as most of you know, different powders have different burn rates. And the same cartridge, again, check your loading manuals, can use a wide variety of powders. And they'll all have differences in their burn rate, you know, going from faster to slower. So another problem you might have if your pistol is not cycling well, you might try different powders. Just like you work up loads, you know, with different bullets, and you'll find that they tend to print a little differently. And not only the weight, but velocities might make them print a little differently. Different powders might improve the function of your specific pistol.
Absolutely. You can get pretty scientific with that, for sure. Different powders, different primers, different seating depths, even the crimp itself, like on your revolvers, how heavy you crimp that can make a big difference. You can also spike the pressure up pretty dramatically by putting too heavy a crimp. If you're going to crimp it heavily, you probably need to back that down about 10% and work your way back up if you're putting a crimp on there that, you know, more than you normally do.
And Rolex made another good point about keeping a reloading log.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a must for sure.
And it's not only for safety, it's to keep you from making the same mistakes year after year.
Yeah, I've got a little wooden, I got it while I was in the Army. I got an 82, I think. Little wooden 3x5 card file. And I've got cards, you know, hundreds of them in there with different loads and different things that I did over the years. That's one of the things where I recorded when I first learned about the little tuft of Dacron or Kapok or something in a very light loaded 38 special. You've done that before, haven't you?
I didn't hear the last part.
Where I've taken a little tuft of Dacron or quilting material, fiber of some kind, for very, very light loaded 38s to get better accuracy out of it?
Oh, well, actually, I don't subscribe to that. I've heard of people doing it for years. It's big in the cast. You also hear stories about that, you know, helping to ring a barrel and cause other problems. So, and my ammunition tends to travel a lot with me. So even if you put that Dacron in the case to keep the powder more or less compressed at the bottom so it's closer to the primer, if you turn the cartridge box upside down, or it's in your range bag, and you bounce over 20 miles of bad road,
right,
I'm not convinced that that's necessarily going to work for the long haul.
Yeah, and I always stored those around. They were strictly for target, and I always stored them upside down. I put them in the case, you know, with the rim down, primer down, for that very reason, so the powder didn't filter through. It also depends on the kind of powder that you use. If you're using a ball powder of some kind, like 231, then it will drift through that Dacron faster than a large flake like Unique or something. But in order to reduce or eliminate that, I stored the rounds upside down and shot them as I needed them, didn't carry them around in the gun or anything like that, just exactly for that reason.
So generally, if I want a really light load, I just go to the published, established sources. When I mentioned ringing barrels, I'm sure you know that you can use a few grains of most fast pistol powder with a lead bullet in a full-size 30 caliber rifle like 308 or 30-06 to get plinking loads.
Sure, absolutely.
And, you know, a lot of guys who do that subscribe to the Dacron in the case procedure, but again, I just subscribe to the published loads, and I dispense with the Dacron if I think there's going to be a problem with misfires. After the round is chambered, tilt your muzzle up skyward to make sure the powder falls back up against the chamber, And then put it horizontal and fire it.
That's how I learned that. It was a complete accident. I was shooting these 38s just all over the place. I knew I was a better shooter than that. And then I noticed, you know, if I pointed it up, not that I was doing it on purpose, but it just happened, and they tightened right up. And I said, what in the world is that? And I got to doing a little research, and that's when I learned about that and started putting that Dacron in there. And, man, I took when, you know, turned 4 or 5-inch groups into 1-inch groups. And worked really well.
What sort of bullets were you using?
I think in those days I was probably using some, I'm pretty sure they were Barry's cast bullets. Rainier bullets. I was buying them at a little Powderhorn gun shop in Fort Irwin, or in Barstow, California.
Oh, and this is something else. It's tangentially related, but you just made me think of it. If you go ultra low on your velocities, remember that there's always a danger of a bullet getting stuck in the barrel.
Certainly. Yep.
And what I'm going to describe now, I actually had happen to me recently. It's possible when you're shooting lead bullets in your reloads that, for one reason or another, aren't well crimped in the case. But probably a month or two ago, I was shooting some of my reloads, 230 grain round nose lead, and got a misfire. So I cycled the weapon, and the next round would not go into battery. And then the little light came on over my head, and I said, aha.
Uh-oh.
Sure enough, when I had chambered that first round, the bullet seated itself in the throat and slightly into the rifling. And when I cycled it, the brass case came out, but not the bullet.
The bullet
it
stuck in the rifling.
It was stuck at the end of the chamber.
Yep, I've seen that.
Not a common thing, but it does happen.
Yep, just as dangerous, nevertheless, if you're not paying attention. And that goes for anything. If you're shooting, you're reloading, you're cleaning your gun, you're doing anything, if something doesn't seem right, you know, you're not paying attention, anything at all, anything seems just a little bit out of place, don't dismiss it. I don't care what it is or how minor it seems. Stop and check it out. It could stop you even from... double loading a charge, double charging your rounds, or a negligent discharge, any number of things. If there's anything at all, anything, stop, get it worked out, and then carry on.
Cope, are you doing 1 hour or 2 hours tonight?
Just one. Why, do you have something else you want to talk about? Nobody follows us, so if we want to.
Yeah, well, one thing that might be a boon to some of our listeners, and that is a method of de-leading a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. How do you usually do it if you had lead build up in a barrel?
You know, in the first place, I've quit doing that, but I used to use the old Lewis lead remover, and I really had good luck with those things. I've still got it, as a matter of fact.
Well, here's something I picked up off of the Cast Bullets website, and it works a treat. Don't know that it's practical or easy to do with revolvers, but on a semi-automatic pistol where you can remove the barrel, this is the bee's knees. Make a solution of 50% dime store hydrogen peroxide and 50% white vinegar. And just let your barrel soak in that. And in about an hour to 3 hours, depending on how heavily leaded the barrel is, it just turns that lead into mush.
Oh, be darn.
Yeah, you can shove it out with a cleaning rod and a paper towel wadded up at the end.
Huh, I'll have to try that. That's neat. Hydrogen peroxide and vinegar, you said? White vinegar?
Yeah, half and half. Hydrogen peroxide and white vinegar.
I will check that out. That sounds neat. The old Lewis lead remover, if you're not familiar with it, was a brass screen about the size of a quarter, and you screw it on to the end of a rod, and there's a a rubber mandrel in there, and you tighten that up enough to make that rubber mandrel expand, and then you push this through, and it was, I mean, you push hard, and you push this thing through, and you'd get stripes of lead, you know, an inch long coming out on that screen. You just take your fingernails and flip that screen a little bit, knock all the lead off of it, do that two or three or four times, and it was clean.
Now, I was a little reluctant to try that at first because vinegar is dilute acetic acid, emphasis on the word acid. So I don't know what would happen if you inadvertently left your barrel in it for a day or two.
Yeah.
You know, one of those things where you put it in the disposable plastic cup and then walk away because the baby's crying or the dog's barking or mama's screaming or whatever's happening and forget about it. I stayed on top of mine very closely when I first tried it to make sure I wasn't etching the barrel or causing any harm.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently I didn't, but longest I've ever done it was for 3 hours. So
yeah.
If you guys want to try it longer, it's up to you.
Yeah, I might do it. I've got some pieces of old barrels around here. I may do that just for the heck of it and let it soak for, you know, 2 or 3 days or a week and see if there's any measurable difference in just for the heck of it. Well, all right, well, Doc, as usual.
For me, so I will say good night, as usual. Always fun talking with you.
Yeah,
thanks,
I appreciate
guys,
it.
For staying up. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Good night, Doc. Thank you. All right, there's our own Doc Toops there. It's a wealth of knowledge that man is. Always great to have him on the air when we're talking about guns and stuff. So that's going to wrap us up for tonight, and like I said, the only class we have coming up that's carved in stone right now is the one coming up in Snowflake in Taylor this coming Saturday. And we've got so many other things going on that I've been hesitant to schedule any classes until I get my schedule cleared out a little bit, and then I'll get some other classes put together. We have so many things happening around here right now. So as soon as that changes, I'll let y'all know. And until then, I guess we'll see y'all Friday night for Liberty Lounge. Good night. Wait. That's not right. This is right. Yeah. There we go. Well, that wraps up another edition of The Shooting Bench. Join me Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific. And again on Fridays from 7 to 10 for The Shooting Bench. Good night, and thanks for joining me. No explanation, no reconciliation. No, let's talk it over, number I can call. Goodbye says it all. Says it all.